kingdom has sent you?
The kingdom of the Most High.
What gifts do you bring?
We bring you the word of God. Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, let my people go.
Familiar voice, Charlton Heston, who will forever in some people's minds be Moses, quite different from the Moses of the Old Testament, who begins quite humbly, a slave, if not abandoned, at least set adrift to save his life, adopted by a princess, a murderer, a refuge from the law, a shepherd, and finally a prophet and a savior, small s. Quite a story to tell. That's why the Bible takes so much space in the first few chapters telling the story of Moses, but really the story of God's deliverance through Moses. We're going to be talking about Moses with Dr. David Adams, and the story is so big we need to take the next 40 minutes to do it. That's plenty of time for you to call with your questions or your comments. We are coming to you live this Thursday, September the 4th. Our toll-free number, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-MYIE, and our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. Dr. David Adams is Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, author of the forthcoming Concordia Commentary on Genesis. Dr. Adams, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Todd.
What I'm curious about is not the beginning of the story to begin with, but the end of the story, where somebody, either Joshua or Moses probably, wrote of Moses, and there has not arisen a prophet since in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, none like him for all the signs and wonders the Lord sent him to do, and all of the mighty power and great deeds of terror that Moses did in the sight of Israel. That's high praise for this man. Is it altogether true?
Well, of course it's altogether true. It reminds me of a very liberal commentator in the Old Testament. Well, not very liberal, but at least not very conservative by traditional terms. William F. Albright, who once noted that if we denied the existence of Moses, we would have to invent someone else by the same name. The point he was trying to make is that Moses dominates the Old Testament in a way that most modern Christian readers often fail to appreciate. Moses and his writing from his recording, the Word of God, are central to the entire Old Testament and also central to a proper understanding of Christ as the fulfillment of the Old Testament. And that's why I think it's both instructive and useful to begin where you did with this statement in Deuteronomy 34, verse 10, that there has not been a prophet like Moses. Because if you ask most people what Moses did or what they think of when they think of Moses, they would think of Moses as lawgiver first. They had to characterize Moses with one word, it would be lawgiver. But to suggest that Moses is just a lawgiver is to miss the most important thing about Moses. He did not simply give the law, but he interpreted it and applied it to Israel's life. And this function of Moses as interpreter of the law and one who applies the Torah, the teaching of God, to the life of Israel is what makes him unique and distinctive, the prototype prophet, if you will, on which all the other prophets are based. The very next great prophet, Elijah, brings out this point, because if you compare the Elijah story to the account of Elijah to the book of Exodus, you find that time and again, Elijah is doing things that are reminiscent of what Moses did. And the cumulative effect of all of these actions is to underscore that Elijah is now the new Moses, that is the next one in the following the prototype prophet. So Moses is not just lawgiver. He is a great many other things that we'll talk about along the way today. But first and foremost, he is the prototypical prophet that points the way not only to the rest of the prophets in the Old Testament, but also to Christ in his role as prophet.
Is this why both Moses and Elijah make their appearance at the Mount of Transfiguration with Christ?
Probably so. Moses and Elijah are the two, if you ask most Christians today to name big prophets in the Old Testament, most people would quite rightly mention Isaiah and maybe Jeremiah. These are the prophets that, or perhaps Daniel, depending on one's theological orientation. These are the prophets that most Christians read today because, and we think of them immediately, of course, because they have books named after them. But Isaiah and Jeremiah and Daniel, the other prophets, for all of their importance in the Old Testament, all of these stand in the shadow of Moses and of Moses' successor, Elijah.
He is, at least initially from the time shortly after his birth, raised as an Egyptian, but he seems to be aware of his Hebrew lineage. Talk about his origins.
Yes. The question about how much Moses knew of his Hebrew origin is an interesting one. You know, we are told that Moses is born. We're not given the exact date anywhere in the text. We're told that it was a time after a pharaoh arose who didn't know anything about Joseph. This probably refers to the period of the 18th dynasty after the expulsion of the Hyksos rulers of Egypt. The Hyksos were one or two dynasties of pharaohs who were Semites, like the Hebrews. They were related to the Hebrews. They weren't native Egyptians. And so in the light of this, the Egyptians are very concerned about this large Semitic population in the Delta. And so they say in Exodus 1, the Pharaoh is aware of this, and he says there are too many Israelites in verse 9, and they're concerned that if they continue to multiply, that the Israelites will side with their enemies. And here he appears to mean have in mind Hyksos or foreign people who will come to attempt to rule Egypt again. And so it's in the light of that geopolitical situation that Pharaoh decides to take action. And part of that action is not only oppressing the Hebrew people who lived in the Delta, but also reducing their population. And so the midwives are instructed that male children shall be killed in order to reduce the population. And in one instance, at least, the midwives, in chapter 1, verse 17, feared God and didn't do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. And in the case of Moses, that meant not only did he live, but his mother was aware that if she continued to raise him, that his life would be in danger. And so she, 3 months after he was born, she put him in a basket, a wicker-type basket, probably lined with some kind of pitch or tar to make it waterproof, although the text doesn't give us detail. Oh, I'm sorry, does give us that detail in verse 3 of chapter 2. And then set it adrift in the Nile, or probably in one of the branches of the Nile in the Delta, where it's found by the daughter of Pharaoh. We're not given her name, and Pharaohs, since they typically had multiple wives, had many children. Daughters aren't very often mentioned in Egyptian records, except in some unusual circumstances. So we don't know anything about this particular daughter of Pharaoh. But she saw the child, and she raised it in the court of Pharaoh. So presumably would have had an Egyptian education. Now, we're told in chapter 2 that the child was nursed by a Hebrew woman, and the Hebrew woman was its own mother. And so it appears, although the text doesn't tell us explicitly, it appears that Moses was educated in the traditions of his own people, as well as in the traditions of the Egyptian court. Because later on, when Moses sees a Hebrew man being abused, he knows that he is a Hebrew, that is to say, he himself is a Hebrew. So on the basis of that tenuous evidence, it's often assumed that Moses did know the traditions. He knew who he was. He knew who his ancestors were. And he also then knew something of the traditions of his people. But the text doesn't tell us much about that, because it's not Moses, it's not Moses' youth that matters to the unfolding story in the book of Exodus, but rather it's the story of the way God called and used Moses. And so the text skips over most of Moses' youth, just as the New Testament skips over most of the youth of Jesus.
We're talking with Dr. David Adams about Moses. Dr. Adams is Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis and author of the forthcoming Concordia Commentary on Genesis. When we come back, we've come to that point in the story where things go terribly wrong for Moses. It's really his own fault. Looking this way and that, he strikes the Egyptian and buries him in the sand, only to discover that in spite of his careful attempt to keep it secret, it wasn't secret after all. He has to flee and then live as a shepherd in Midian, where at long last God finds him. God calls him and sends him back exactly to the place he doesn't want to go, back to where he is a wanted man, back to where his people are still waiting in slavery. Oh, I got a question about that. When we come back, what does it mean that they were slaves? Does it mean they were a slave class? Does it mean that they were enslaved in some formal way? We're here to respond to your questions or comments on Moses. Talk back at issuesetc.org or 1-877-623-MYIE.
Grace, faith, Scripture, and Christ alone. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Issues Etc. is a team effort. Your phone calls, email, and snail mail help resurrect this worldwide outreach. Now we need your help to sustain Issues Etc. by making a gift to Lutheran Public Radio today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or by check, Lutheran Public Radio, Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. Help support Christ-centered, cross-focused talk radio for the thinking Christian.
Death and suffering, why do they exist?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the eye-opening book, How Could a Loving God?
Perhaps the most asked question we receive, and it comes from both non-Christians and Christians, is this: if God is love, why is there so much death and suffering in the world? And you know, the only way to answer this question is to start with the Bible and Genesis. Let me share a story. I visit Northern Ireland from time to time, including last May, and I remember once talking to a young couple who were very angry at God. Their parents had been blown up by a bomb. So I sat down and I opened my Bible to Genesis and showed them about sin. I explained that they shouldn't be angry at God, they should be angry at sin, their sin, my sin, your sin, everyone's sin. You see, suffering and death entered the world because of the sin of the first man, Adam. And we're all in rebellion against God because we're all descendants of Adam and Eve. That's why there's death and suffering. So when we see such terrible things as bombings, we should fall on our knees before a holy God and confess our sinfulness.
Since September 11, 2001, perhaps the most asked question we receive is, if there's a God, why is there so much death and terrorism in this world? That question's answered in Ken Ham's booklet, and we'll send 10 of them out to you, suitable for witnessing, for your gift of any size today. Just go to our website, answersoffer.org, or call us toll-free, 1-888-89-ANSWERS, 888-89-ANSWERS.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Tomorrow on the program, Zacharias and Elizabeth will be talking about this pair. Dr. Peter Scare will be our guest. Moses is our subject today. Dr. David Adams, Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, is our guest. Our email address this Thursday, September the 4th, talkback at issuesetc.org, and our call-in number, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-MYIE. Dr. Adams, before we go on with the story of Moses, what does it mean that, this people, these descendants of Jacob, were slaves in Egypt? I guess I've never entertained the question, but when I was listening to you talk about it before, it's not as though they could have all, every last one of them, been slave to one master. Were they a slave class? What do we believe they? What was their status in Egypt?
That's a very good question. The Hebrew word "eved," we might write it E-V-E-D or something like that. But the Hebrew word "eved," that's commonly translated "slave," doesn't necessarily mean a personal slave, someone who is owned as property of another person, although it often means that. It can also be a very general term for servant, someone who serves another. By calling the Hebrew slaves, the text does not mean to say that they were all personal slaves, that they were all owned property, but rather probably means that they were an underclass in Egyptian society who were without a large measure of political or legal rights or protection, and that they were probably required to be part of the forced labor that was used by the Egyptian state to build cities. We read early in the book of Exodus that the Hebrews were engaged in the building of some cities in the Delta. And it's likely that that's what's meant by slaves, that they were an underclass without full legal rights, and that they were required to serve in the corvée, or the forced labor pool, which was quite common in Egypt.
Okay, we pick up where Moses finds one of his countrymen being beaten as a slave by a master, and he kills the Egyptian. I've wondered since I was a little kid, you know, he's part of, at least ostensibly, part of the periphery of Pharaoh's house. And would that have necessarily gotten him in any trouble?
Well, that's a question we don't know for sure. We don't know exactly what Moses' status was by the time that he had reached adulthood. As the text tells us, he went out and saw his people, the Hebrews, being abused, one in particular being beaten, and struck him down. So we assume that Moses had some sort of role in the Pharaoh's household, but the Pharaoh had a very, very large household, particularly if you include all of the sort of subsidiary offices. And it may be that Moses' position in the house of Pharaoh was not one that would give him sort of extraordinary exemption under the law from serious crimes like murder. So it's not unreasonable to think that Moses' fear was a legitimate one in this case. By the way, I just want to mention this account of Moses committing murder is a good example of something that we see in the Old Testament time and time again. Namely, the Old Testament doesn't depict the people of God as sort of what I like to call plastic saints. You know, often more liberals in the church like to argue that all this was made up many centuries after the fact for various political and or theological reasons. But usually when stories are made up long after the fact like that, the heroes of the stories are depicted as faultless people, as sort of ideal citizens, the ideal to which one should aspire. And seldom do the people of the Old Testament ever come across as that sort of ideal person that one would model oneself after. They're all flawed people because they're real people. And this account of Moses committing murder here in anger at seeing one of his kinsmen being beaten reflects the reality, the substance of the biblical record. And so it's a useful point by itself as well.
He flees and finds a wife and a livelihood for a number of decades, I believe,
yes,
as a shepherd. Where exactly is he now then geographically in relationship to his home of Egypt?
Well, somewhere to the east, although where exactly to the east is a matter of a lot of debate, a lot of scholarly debate. We're told that he joined the household of Jethro, who was a Midianite. Elsewhere, Jethro is described as a Kenite. Both of these tribes, and they may be closely related to one another, we don't know that much about them. but they appear to be nomadic groups. At a later period in the history of the Bible, the Midianites were identified as being in what is today the northwestern part of Saudi Arabia. But in we know from archaeology that there were Midianite groups, there's Midianite artifacts, shall we say, that occur as far north as Edom, which is just barely to the southeast of Israel, and to modern Jordan, southern part of modern Jordan, and also in the Sinai Peninsula, the western, northwestern part of the northeastern part, excuse me, of the Sinai Peninsula. So somewhere around what is today modern Eilat, where the Gulf of Aqaba comes up on the east side of the Sinai Peninsula, somewhere around that area is probably where the Midianites were. And so Moses probably, when he fled Egypt, fled across the Sinai Peninsula to the east and met up with Jethro somewhere on the east side of the Sinai Peninsula. But there's nothing that we know either from the Bible or from history or from archaeology that can really help us pin it down much more than that.
When God appears to him in the burning bush and says, go get my people and then bring them back here. Is this what would then be later called Sinai? Is he on that very mountain to which he would return to receive the covenant?
Yes, he is, although it's a matter of debate that we definitely can't go into all the details here, a matter of debate as to where exactly that mountain was. But yes, it is whatever that mountain is, it's the same mountain to which Moses led them back later. God says that you will come back here and worship me after I lead you out of Egypt, after I lead my people out of Egypt. So they do return there later on. By the way, in the movie, since you referenced Charlton Heston at the beginning, by the way, did I ever tell you I met Charlton Heston once?
No.
Yeah. In fact, I was with a friend of mine in Washington, D.C., and Charlton Heston was speaking at the National Rifle Association meeting, and we gave him a little a copy of the Ten Commandments and met with him for a few minutes and chatted with him. I pointed out to him, I always wanted to say this to Charlton Heston, that in the movie, you know, he's carrying the Ten Commandments, these two huge tablets of stones. And I wanted to point out, I pointed out to him that, you know, the Ten Commandments were probably actually written on something that one could hold in the palm of one's hand or stick in one's shirt pocket.
What did Mr. Heston make of that scholarly revelation?
He laughed. He thought it was very funny. He was a very pleasant man, although a lot shorter and less imposing in person than he is on the screen or even when he's speaking in public. He was a somewhat mild man in person, sort of face-to-face.
That's interesting, a little bit like Moses himself, who seems to, at least in his own esteem, when God is calling him there at the burning bush, consider himself completely unfit to go and speak with the prince of Egypt and to go and be the mouthpiece for God.
Yes, in this account, in Exodus chapter 3 and 4, God calls Moses, and Moses doesn't want to go. He keeps coming up with good reasons why he shouldn't go. After Exodus 3:14, after Exodus 3, maybe 10, 12, somewhere in there, God sends Moses, and Moses responds in verse 11, "Who am I that I should go?" And then he comes up with four objections each time, raising a new point, and God answers his objection each time. And then Moses basically says at the end, in chapter 4, Moses basically says, well, okay, thanks, but no thanks. You know, thanks for thinking of me, but no thanks. And God, in effect, says, well, you didn't understand. I wasn't asking you to go. I was sending you. And so so God sends him, and Moses ultimately obeys the call of God and undertakes the formidable task of going back to Egypt where his life was endangered and being God's agent for redeeming, that is, rescuing his people, bringing them out of bondage, and ultimately leading them to the land that God had promised them.
Dr. David Adams is our guest. We're going to take another break. When we come back, 10 more minutes on Moses. The church remembers this Old Testament saint, perhaps the towering saint of the Old Testament, Moses, on this day, Thursday, September the 4th. Dr. David Adams is Associate Professor of Old Testament Concordia Seminary, author of the forthcoming Concordia Commentary on Genesis. We'll take your questions, your phone calls, and your email on Moses after this break. 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-MYIE. Our email address here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org. One of the strangest incidents in Moses' life, right after this.
Here's an easy way for you to publicize Issues Etc. at your church. Go to the promote page of our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find a short paragraph to include in your weekly church bulletin. Help inform your fellow parishioners about Issues Etc. Issuesetc.org, click promote, and copy and paste the text for your church secretary or pastor to include each week in the Sunday bulletin. We update this paragraph weekly. IssuesETC.org.
We've got nothing against bumper stickers, just bumper sticker theology. And we'd like to send you the new Issues Etc. bumper sticker. You'll find the Issues Etc. logo, slogan, and website address. Simply send your request to Lutheran Public Radio, 1600 Gulfview Drive, Suite 230, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Please include a self-addressed stamped envelope. Good theology doesn't fit on a bumper sticker, but you can tell people where to find good theology, the new Issues Etc. bumper or window sticker.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues Etc.
What does Planned Parenthood have to hide?
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
In recent years, the number of abortions performed by Planned Parenthood in the United States has risen almost 30%. But could this powerful, well-funded organization be running scared? Apparently so. The last few months witnessed two separate occasions where Planned Parenthood willingly deceived citizens about abortion clinics being built in their area to avoid likely protests by the community. If, as the organization claims, a substantial majority of Americans favor abortion on demand, why all the secrecy? It seems that in reality, Planned Parenthood does not even buy its own rhetoric.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. 10 more minutes on Moses as the church remembers this Old Testament saint. Dr. David Adams is our guest. Steve is on the line in St. Louis. Steve, thanks for waiting.
Thank you. A couple of things I noticed. One thing is the interaction between Moses and Pharaoh. And I know that it's real interesting because in the Bible, Moses has full access to the court of Pharaoh throughout all the time. And I thought that even though there was problems with the animated movie of the Prince of Egypt, I thought they captured kind of the interaction well between Pharaoh and Moses. The other thing I find interesting is if you look at it, and all the plagues that God performed through Moses, they systematically go in and destroy the concept of the Egyptian gods.
All right, thank you very much, Steve. Two good points. Does Pharaoh have kind of unfettered access? Moses unfettered access to the court of Pharaoh once he makes it to Egypt?
Yes, he appears to. And that may not be quite as astonishing as it would seem to us. In the ancient world, it was the case that most kings held a sort of regular public court, and it was possible for the average citizen to come and to speak to the king, if not all the time, at least at certain appointed times when the king carried out his function as judge or arbiter of legal cases. So it may be that at least initially Moses appeared at one of those public sessions where the Pharaoh was in public and accessible to the citizens. And then later on, once the initial contact is made, he does appear until the very end when Pharaoh tells him, you know, don't come back again. He apparently has the privilege of coming into the court of Pharaoh and speaking with him, if not regularly, if not any time, at least on a regular basis.
The second question that Steve, or the comment that he made about the plagues that are brought through Moses by God, paralleling in some way the pantheon of Egypt at the time.
Yeah, generally that's true. It's very difficult. Many scholars have attempted to line up a plague with a specific god of Egypt, apart from the plague of darkness, which is clearly directed at the sun god, the most important god or group of gods in the Egyptian pantheon. It's really very difficult to sort of create a one-on-one matchup. There are so many different Egyptian gods, hundreds, maybe even thousands in reality. There are many gods whose responsibilities overlap. You know, there are four or five gods who are responsible for the same thing, and also different gods who are responsible for different aspects of nature in the various worship centers of Egypt. So it's really very difficult to come up with a one-on-one correlation. But one thing is clear, the net effect of all of the plagues is to undermine the order, the cosmic order, which it was the responsibility of the gods of Egypt to preserve in Egyptian theology. And so whether you want to try to identify one particular god for each plague, which I would not do, or whether you just want to see them collectively as undermining the authority of the gods, clearly what the God of Israel does is declare war on the gods of Egypt, and ultimately, of course, emerge from that war victorious.
Okay, speaking of the God of Israel, and I mean we're accustomed to this notion of him, say in the end, killing the firstborn of Egypt before Moses ever even makes it back to Egypt. In fact, while he's on the way camping out, these three verses, and if you can explain this one, you get the gold star of issues, etc. Verse 24, and we're talking about chapter 4.
I know what you're talking about.
They stop at night. God tries to kill Moses, and his wife Zipporah apparently intervenes by circumcising Moses' son, throwing the foreskin at Moses' feet. She says, "Surely you have become to me a bridegroom of blood," and God lets Moses live. What in the world is this about?
I know, to be honest, I have no idea. This is probably the most obscure, or one of the most obscure verses or incidents in the entire Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. Why it's here, what its point is in the narrative is very difficult, except that it makes it clear that Moses had not fulfilled God's command to circumcise his own sons, and maybe that's what's behind this, and since he fails to do it, Zipporah does it for him. But frankly, the details of this incident escape everybody, everybody's attempt to explain them. I've read, I don't know, maybe a dozen or more commentaries on the book of Exodus, probably more than a dozen. I've never seen a really satisfactory explanation of this verse. So I'm afraid it's one of these rare places in the Bible where the exact meaning of what is being communicated is sort of lost to us today.
Okay, a silver star for at least admitting that there's no clear answer to the question. Okay, then let's deal with the deliverance itself. After the plagues have been carried out and the people have been delivered from Egypt, it almost sounds like Moses is telling Pharaoh, just let us go to that mountain, worship, and then we'll all come back, don't worry. But of course, they never come back. Is he in some way deceiving Moses? Pharaoh?
Well, yeah, that's a very good question. He's at least letting Pharaoh mislead himself. If Moses isn't outright deceiving Pharaoh, he's at least allowing Pharaoh to deceive himself. He certainly gives the impression that they're going to go 3 days out from Egypt and come back. Pharaoh, of course, doubts this from the beginning. That's why he doesn't want to let the Hebrews take their property with them. And finally, as the sequence of plagues unfolds, he is pressured into agreeing to allow them to take their property and their wives and children with them, and ultimately, of course, to let them go. But it's not accidental, I don't think, that it's after 3 days that Pharaoh decides to go get them and bring them back again. He sort of realizes that they're not going to come back, and so he heads out with his army to force them to come back. So whether Moses deceives Pharaoh or whether he simply allows Pharaoh to be deceived in his own mind, clearly there's some confusion about whether they ever intend to come back or not. And, of course, Moses knows that they are not going to come back because God is delivering them from Egypt. And that's really what leads us to the point of why the church recognizes today as a day to commemorate Moses, because Moses' work is not ultimately about giving the law. This kind of takes us back to where we began with our discussion. What's ultimately Moses' role is that of prophet, certainly of lawgiver, but also of redeemer. That is to say, he's God's agent in effecting the redemption or the salvation of God's people from bondage. And in this way, Moses isn't just a historical figure in the Old Testament, but he's also an anticipation, or as we say in theology, a type of Christ who is to come. And it's because Moses is a type or foreshadowing of Christ who is to come, who not only interprets the law, who is a prophet, who is a priest like Moses, who is a ruler or king. Moses isn't a king, he's a ruler. A leader, but Christ is greater than that. He's eternal king as well. In all these ways, Christ is the fulfillment of what Moses begins. And so by pointing to Moses today, the church also points to Christ and the cross, who Moses anticipates.
Dr. David Adams is Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, author of the forthcoming Concordia Commentary on Genesis. Dr. Adams, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for being our guest.
Thank you for having me, Todd. I'm sorry I couldn't answer your question about Genesis chapter 4 about the bridegroom of blood. But if I ever find an answer, I'll be sure to call in and share it with you and your listeners.
Absolutely. And you know, he's in good company, folks, because I've never found – that's why I promised the gold star. It's easy to promise something you know you're not going to have to deliver, because I've never found anyone who can give a really good explanation for what that's doing there. So not all the questions about Moses get answered, but the important one is. Jesus really answers the question himself, doesn't he? When the followers of Moses, the disciples of Moses, come to him, his opponents, and they think Moses is nothing but a lawgiver. That's exactly what they think about Moses. Moses is just the guy who gave us the basic rules before leaving earth or whatever it is. And Jesus has the audacity to tell these men, schooled in the writings of Moses, if you read Moses, really read Moses, you'd be reading about me. If you believed Moses, you would believe in me, for Moses wrote of me. And Paul can later say that when these same opponents of Jesus, whoever they may be, read Moses, they read with a veil over their face. But when Christ comes, the veil is taken away. Because Moses isn't only writing rules and regulations and laws for people to keep and thereby somehow render service to and please God. Moses is anticipating, foretelling, and as the greatest prophet who ever lived up until Christ himself, Moses is speaking of Christ. In fact, we're told that Moses is a preacher of Christ. Jesus says, he wrote about me. Someone greater than even Moses? Yes. The one who came, Moses gave the law, Jesus kept the law. Moses explained the law, Jesus obeyed the law. Jesus, the one who appeared to Moses in the burning bush and there at Sinai, who gave Moses this law and passed it on to his people by way of covenant, he comes in human flesh and he keeps this law, he obeys this covenant, and he fulfills everything Moses wrote about and everything Moses lived out in his life. Moses, small redeemer, small R redeemer. Jesus, redeemer, capital R, our redeemer, through his death and his resurrection. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 1046, San Juan Capistrano, California, 92693. Box 1046, SJC, California, 92693. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org.
Issues, Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.